Right now it's time for Crime and Punishment. Each week we check with Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. And this week, news that charges were filed against the protesters who shut down I-5 back in January, part of that pro-Palestinian demonstration. The big question for Casey, why did it take so long?
Probably the best way to explain this is to compare it to the SeaTac protest that happened a week ago. And in that one, there were 46 people who were charged because, well, what really helped was that those people who were arrested and charged with misdemeanors as well were booked, fingerprinted, photographed, identified on the spot. And so there wasn't any question of who was there. A lot of people forget that in the I-5 protest, the police and troopers that responded didn't arrest people that day. And so that made a very different legal scenario of proving the identities of the people who were there. Also, there's this factor. You want to have the strongest possible cases. Most people only look at a case when it first is filed, and prosecutors probably could have gotten a better headline if the cases were rushed, but we know that we want to have the strongest possible case. It doesn't help to have a favorable headline for prosecutors, but then have the cases dismissed down the road. And so we worked with the State Patrol back and forth every week until we filed these to make sure that we had the strongest possible cases, and we have those now.
But I think one of the thoughts across my mind was in the I-5 protest, the way it started was you had all these people who drove cars there and abandoned them.
Right.
Now, those cars have license plates. Presumably, you can track that, find the owners, and that would lead you to the people who drove them out of the road.
Right. And that's what the State Patrol did for one person, and they referred it to us, and are trying to do for others. And so that's really probably a better question for the State Patrol, but they are working on that. They sent one of those drivers to us, and he's facing charges.
Right. Well, I understand it's probably easier to handle a protest at the airport because it's a confined space, and you know it's harder to run away.
Yeah,
than it is from I-5.
That's one thing too.
So what would be required then to handle the next I-5 protest in a way that gets charges filed more quickly?
Well, I think that SeaTac certainly benefited from having I-5 first because they knew what to look for, knew what to do. And that's not a criticism of the State Patrol for I-5. When you have good knowledge that it could happen and it might happen, you can get those resources together for a quick, immediate, and appropriate response.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the tactics that was used, I believe, in both demonstrations was the whole sleeping dragon thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is what makes it difficult to remove people because they've got their hands locked together in pipes and you're not allowed to injure somebody just because they're sitting in the street. But the other side of this is when you block a road for that long, you can conceivably cause great harm to people who are stuck in that backup.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so is that accounted for in filing the charges?
It is, and I think that's pretty frustrating for people under state law because what prosecutors are able to file both in SeaTac, which SeaTac Muni did, and our cases with I-5, are misdemeanor charges, disorderly conduct and or criminal trespass for the defendants. And a lot of people say, how's that not a felony crime? How's that not a federal crime? And it's the way that the state law is written. And a lot of people have written to us over the weekend and say, now you're reading the law wrong. And I assure you that multiple senior deputy prosecutors have looked to see if there is a felony crime. We don't have that. That's really what...
Well, there are states, though, where it is a felony crime to block the interstate, aren't there?
Probably somewhere, but Washington would need a different law in this sense. And I think to the people who say, the prosecutors have it wrong, I'm sure you could. Remember that this was referred to us as a misdemeanor crime by the State Patrol. So even if you don't believe prosecutors that this is the best we could do with what evidence we have, I'm sure the people would believe the State Patrol troopers would send us the best possible cases. And if they could send us felonies, they would.
We're hearing from Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. And one of the other things about this I-5 protest case is that there were a plethora of potential problems caused as a result of blocking the highway. So suppose people who are caught in the backup demanded a restitution from the defendants.
You know, that's one thing that has gotten some attention after the San Francisco District Attorney wrote in a tweet on X that people may be entitled to restitution under Marcy's Law. And Marcy's Law is the unique California Victim Bill of Rights that was passed in 2008 by a voter initiative. Washington doesn't have the same voter approved Bill of Rights here like they do in California. And I think the key sentence or the key word in that sentence is may. Marcy's Law is a great law. I hope that the victims do get compensation in California, but it'll be a long time before that happens, and hopefully it does, but there's not a guarantee.
All right. So how many people right now stand accused in connection with the blocking of the airport and the highway?
So there were 12 cases that were sent to us. Six have been charged. Five are still being investigated by the State Patrol. One, we didn't have the legal sufficiency to file a case. There wasn't evidence that the person was clearly on the interstate. And so that was declined. But the other five are still going.
And again, it doesn't matter how noble the cause is. You can't block the freeway.
That's exactly right. It doesn't matter what the cause is. If we got 200 cases, we would look at 200 cases, and each one would be looked at individually and charged where we had the evidence to do so.
Okay. Another case, we had a fatal stabbing at the Muckleshoot Casino, a 29-year-old victim who was stabbed and later died. What's the status of that case?
Auburn police, their initial report said that that looks random. And so we...
Random? Somebody just walked into a casino with a knife and started stabbing people?
Yeah. And we anticipate getting this document for a first appearance hearing this morning. We should have that first appearance at about 1:30 this afternoon in district court. And so we should know more when we get those docs and then have more info by the afternoon.
Yeah. And that other tragic case about the man whose car stalled out on the Ship Canal Bridge and he got out and then was hit.
Yeah, this was such a tragic case. This happened in 2022 at about 4:30 in the morning. The driver who hit and killed him, he pleaded guilty to vehicular homicide and also to DUI. He was given 9 months in jail. And a lot of people would say 9 months
killing
somebody. But really, that was the request of the victim's parents, which was, well, this clip from Erica Zucco from King 5, who covered the sentencing on Friday, really captures it.
In his sentencing, Judge Michael Ryan spoke of this moment. The victim's mother embracing the family of the man convicted of killing her son.
Our family forgives Justin, not because we have to, because we want to.
Teresa Shelley says her family hopes the best for 22-year-old Justin Kuo. She says they do it in honor of the son they say would have done the same.
He was so gifted and exuberant to be here and to make a difference.
In court, Kuo apologized, took responsibility, and warned others not to get behind the wheel, even a little impaired.
I just want them to know that you always think that it couldn't be you.
Kuo said he'll never forget Shelley and will live a kind, straightforward life in his honor. Shelley's mother gave him her blessing.
And I pray and hope on behalf of my family and my husband that this does not define you, Justin, or any of us. We all make mistakes, self-included.
Well, if that's what the family wants, it's hard to argue against that, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a lot of courage and kindness to be able to say that.
Yeah. Casey McNerthley from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thank you, Casey.
Great to see you, Dave.
In Washington, D.C. over the weekend, Congress finally made some headway passing that much-debated foreign aid package, which includes help for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. So I called up CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarland to ask him, with all the back and forth, with all the drama, were there any constructive changes made to that bill?
Yes and no. I mean, this is a big difference from what the Senate passed a couple months ago. I mean, the Senate passed tens of billions of dollars for Ukraine, tens of billions for Israel and for the Indo-Pacific. But the Senate, when they did this in February, passed a major border security revision, as requested by so many people on both sides of the aisle. When the U.S. House finally put pen to paper and did this thing this weekend, the border security stuff was eliminated. So the hardline Republicans, the conservatives in the Freedom Caucus, who helped kill that Senate bill, just allowed their party pass this weekend something that had nothing on border security whatsoever.
So they shot themselves in the foot. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Maybe they helped Donald Trump in the process. Trump wants to campaign on the border, and that Donald Trump was also against the Senate doing something to help alleviate that problem and give a victory to President Biden. But in terms of actually solving the problem, they went in the wrong direction here.
What were the consequences? Do we know anything about how the delay in the case of the Ukraine aid might have affected the progress of Ukraine's attempt to defend itself?
Less money and less munitions doesn't help them. There was the intelligence briefings that were being given to leadership were sobering enough, Dave, that House Speaker Mike Johnson said those intelligence briefings are one of the reasons why he was championing this Ukraine aid package. And Johnson, before he became Speaker, was one of those dissenting voices on more money for Ukraine. So he's done a 180. And I think the tales he was getting from intelligence briefings about the war front or enough to spin them around.
CBS's Scott McFarlane. And so with this bipartisan agreement on foreign aid, does he see Republican lawmakers moving away from Donald Trump?
I didn't see a lot of shift among the Ukraine dissenters. Mike Johnson may be an exception to a rule here, Dave. I mean, there still is this faction by the dozens of House Republicans, a couple dozen Republican senators, too, who say their constituents do not want to spend more U.S. taxpayer money on Ukraine. There wasn't a big shift in terms of the overall number of Republicans. It's just that the House Speaker, who controls everything on the House floor, finally agreed to let it go through. It underscores a couple things here, Dave. First of all, the unique power of the House Speaker, who singularly chooses what gets a vote and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. He moved. Nobody else had to move with him to get this thing through, because there's always been a critical mass, 300-plus House members, who were going to support this. Overwhelming support among Democrats, and a lot of the serious-minded and long-tenured Republicans knew they had to pay for this too. But I'll take a snapshot here, Dave. We may never see this again. This is a moment unlike I've ever seen covering Congress in recent memory, where this is actually a coalition government in effect.
Yeah.
It's Democrats and Republicans doing this in concert, keeping the government open, funding Ukraine, funding Israel. This is almost a parliamentary notion. And at this moment in time, that's how the U.S. House of Representatives is running. We may never see it again.
Well, but I mean, they could get some stuff done. I know it's difficult to do during a campaign year, but if that coalition exists for this, why not bring back the border security bill? Because there are Democrats who want to fix it, too.
Yeah, the House Speaker may get a little more pressure from Donald Trump than he got on the Ukraine money. But this is also a symptom of Trump, isn't it? I mean, there's an incredibly narrow majority in the House. You may think that's one of the reasons why both parties have to do everything. But Nancy Pelosi was navigating a similar majority in 2021. In 2020, when she was the Speaker, I mean, she only had a couple of votes to spare on anything, and she didn't have to do this thing where Republicans helped her pass everything she wanted to pass. I think it's a Trumpian thing, where you have some Republicans who want to serve Trump almost as if he is the sitting president. It's like we have two presidents right now in the U.S. House of Representatives, and it's causing this divide that makes even the easy things, the things that need to get done, difficult. So both parties have to contribute their votes, and Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, is wielding power unseen before in a minority leader.
CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarlane. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Dave.
Is your nest egg big enough, or do you need to lay a bigger one to retire comfortably? Here's CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger on how to calculate your magic number.
There is a number. That's the good news. The bad news is that the number really does depend on you, and it requires a tiny bit of work. Can I give it to you?
Please.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, you know, a lot of people will just guesstimate. Well, I think I need $1 million. It's a round number. And so that number has been going up, and it's been going up steadily over the last, say, 5 to 10 years, but then spiked by 50% over the last few years because of inflation. So everyone just sort of said, well, it should be bigger than a million. I'm sure it's $1.5 million. And so that's how this number comes up. The real way to determine the amount of money you need for retirement is to consult one of these fabulous retirement calculators. They're with every 401k, 403b plan. They're very easy to use, but it requires a bit of work on your end. Are you ready for your work, Dave?
What do I have to do?
The hardest part is the simplest. We have to tell the calculator how much you're spending today.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I know. So why is it hard? Because look, tallying up all the money you spend, it's a bit of an emotional hurdle for a lot of people. It feels awful. Don't judge it. Just track your spending for 90 days. I'm not asking you to create a budget. Budgets usually don't work. They're sort of like diets. But you just need to know how much you're spending. Because if you don't know what you're spending today, it's hard to project what you think you'll spend in the future. So I like to use whatever you're spending today as a benchmark. Yes, maybe if you're saving gobs and gobs and gobs of money right now, you're going to enter in what you're spending. You're going to have all that savings. It's going to really work for you, and you'll get a number, and maybe you'll feel relieved. But maybe you don't make that much money, but you've forgotten you have an amazing pension plan. Maybe you're a municipal worker or a government employee. These things can make up a lot of ground for you. But without a semblance of where you are today, it is awfully difficult to project into the future.
Do you have to track all your spending, like, you know, the fancy latte you get every day, stuff like that?
Well, look, I'm not one of these people, and it's been wildly overstated that, like, not drinking a latte will make you a millionaire, because that doesn't work. But what I would say is that you want to track your spending so that you can get an estimation of what could you be spending in your future. So, you know, do I think it's, are you going to spend less money commuting when you're 69 than when you're 49? Yes. But, you know, if you love to play golf and you belong to a club, then, or you like to travel around and, you know, play different golf courses, or you are really, really into going to see your grandchildren on different coasts,
yes,
you got to factor that in. Because if you don't factor it in, you are going to be surprised in the future. I hate surprises. So surprises will crop up anyway, because that is what like living in the universe is like a surprise, good or bad, will pop up. But if we can do a general amount of planning, it might eliminate some of those surprises that do tend to pop up at the least convenient time.
We're hearing from CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. And to me, the important question is, do most people have a realistic idea of what it will take for them to retire in the future?
What we know is that a lot of people who are like sort of facing retirement are facing a very uncertain future. And so what I can tell you is that the amount of money, let's say the, if you look at like the average amount or the, sorry, the median amount of savings for all retirement accounts, it's a very low number. You know, it's like $87,000.
Wow.
But if you are thinking about people who are getting closer to retirement, the number is higher, right? So, you know, I think if you're what we call a peak boomer, which is someone who is turning 65 between now and 2030, there's like 30 million of those people. Those folks have saved, again, median $225,000. That doesn't seem like a million and a half, but maybe they don't need that much. Again, some of this is about what you're willing to do in retirement. And if you're willing to have a side hustle during retirement, if you're willing to have a little extra income come in, or if one of you, if you're in a couple and one of you is, say, you know, very happy at work and you delay your retirement, all these things can help. The thing that's a little bit scary to me is how many people I hear from who will say, oh, I'm just going to work forever. Huh. Okay. Well, that's a great plan, but that you know, there has to be another party to that agreement. In other words, you have to work in an industry that's still going to want you in the future. And I think that's a little scary to me, because as someone in media and talking to people all the time who are losing their jobs, who had thought they were going to work till they were 65 and they're losing their jobs and they're 52, that's a real shift. So what I would say is this: if you are thinking, I'm just going to work forever, still run the numbers, because, you know, some people get retired. They are laid off, forced out, or their health or their spouse's health drive them out of the labor force. And I think that these are things that we don't like to think about, and they can be unlucky events in life. And yeah, so that's why I think running the numbers is incredibly important.
Yeah. These days, forever can come sooner than you think.
I know. I mean, look, the Knicks are in the playoffs, so there is a magical, helpful event that's happening right now. Shocking and delightful. And the other ones happen also.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The World Health Organization is warning that a bird flu virus has made the leap to cows, and they're worried about the next step. Let's page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. you began your note to me, Dr. Cohen, by saying, here we go again. Are you really worried about this?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting announcement. The chief scientist of the World Health Organization said this past week that this virus, it's called H5N1, is of tremendous concern. And he's really calling for more tracking and preparation for a potential, you know, pandemic even within the human population. So the thing is, it's not a new virus. So it's been around since 1996, and it's a flu strain that was first detected in birds and has really primarily been a threat to farmed and wild fowl. So there's not going to be a debate about where this came from. If it makes its way into the human population, it's not going to be a debate about whether it came out of a lab or a wet market or whatnot. We're aware of the virus. But what is new, and has happened in the past few years, is that there's been an increasing number of mammals who have tested positive for the virus. And this indicates that the virus is maybe looking for new hosts. And if the hosts are other mammals, then it's moving closer to people.
And it's already been detected in cattle herds in this country, right?
As of now, there's been 29 infected herds in 8 different states, including Texas, New Mexico, Kansas, South Dakota, Idaho, Michigan, and Ohio, and North Carolina. And in fact, there have been a couple of cases where humans have gotten infected in the United States. A human got infected from an infected cow. And the other was a poultry worker who got infected in 2022 in Colorado. So it doesn't transmit easily from human to human because nobody around these two people have gotten sick.
The people who were infected by this have been working with live cattle. This isn't affecting people who like eat the meat. I assume cooking meat would kill it, right?
I mean, we don't really know yet, right? So far, it is two people who were working around infected animals, one from a cow and one from who was a poultry worker. So, you know, and there have been no cases reported from human to human transmission. Having said that, the reason that the World Health Organization and other researchers are worried is because since 2003, so over, you know, the past 20 years, couple of decades, there actually have been 889 human cases reported, but 463 of these people died. And this was in 23 different countries. So this would give the virus a case fatality rate of about 52%. So that's why there's concern. But there's only been 2 cases in the United States. There's been 22 other countries that have had, you know, 887 other cases, but the mortality rate is really high.
Now, I saw in the article that they're already working on a template for a vaccine, which indicates to me that if it were to make the jump, we'd have a vaccine much faster than we did last time?
Yeah. So again, the virus isn't new. It's been around for a long time. And what's interesting is, at least in the United States, there were these 2 cases. And what they found was that the most recent case, they treated the person with antiviral medications and it treated the virus. So existing antiviral medications were able to kill it. They were able to create a candidate vaccine that could be used, like you said, as a template to make a vaccine if needed. But they haven't started on making a vaccine yet. If it makes its way into humans, it's going to mutate in order to get into humans. And if it's looking for a new host so that it can spread, then it'll be modified enough where potentially the antiviral medications that were used to treat this most recent human case may or may not work. And we may find ourselves in the position of having to create new antivirals. And we may, it would be at that time that we would start to try and create a vaccine.
All right. Well, I've got some extra masks standing by. I also have a box of hazmat suits. Not sure why I have those, but...
Well, I'm glad you're ready.
By the way, I'm told that we have now been doing this feature for 7 years, which is amazing because it feels like 8 or 9.
We are. We just passed our 7-year anniversary of doing this. So, yeah, it does feel like 8 or 9, I guess, but it's been fun.
That sounded wild. Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. It's a story from CBS's Steve Hartman.
A lot of kids in America want to run a lemonade stand, but not many feel like they have to. 7-year-old Emery Johnson started her business a few weeks ago after a terrible nightmare morning.
I woke up with the worst news of my life.
Emery's mother, Carly, died unexpectedly at the age of 29. She was a single mom and Emery's everything.
We go see mommy.
Which is why she couldn't understand, first time she went to the cemetery with her grandmother Jennifer, why everyone else got giant granite headstones, but her mom, just this tiny metal one.
Did that bother you? Mm-hmm. Why?
Because because it felt like she was being left out.
Her grandma tried to explain how they couldn't afford a headstone right now.
She had tears in her eyes and wanted to help.
So she did the only thing that she could think of to raise money.
Yes.
I made a lemonade stand.
A lemonade stand to pay for her mother's headstone. At first, she didn't make mention of her cause.
Thank you.
But word got out.
Thank you.
And before long,
thank you.
Emery says it seemed like just about everyone here in Scottsboro, Alabama, was thirsty for lemonade. The price was a dollar.
Thank you.
But she says people liked it so much.
How many cups do you want?
They often paid more.
Thank you. The most that we got for one cup of lemonade was $300.
For lemonade?
Yeah, for one cup.
Whoa! So far, Emery's lemonade stand has raised more than $15,000, which will all go into savings because a monument company is now donating the headstone. But more importantly, Emery has taken that lemon life handed her and squeezed out hope.
Her comment was when all these people came, she couldn't believe so many people cared for and loved her mommy.
They always say it takes a village to raise a child. But sometimes it also takes a village to mourn a mom. Folks around here take that role seriously, offering Emery comfort by the cupful and all the love she can drink.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And that's sweet.
That is precious.
Yeah.
Seattle's Morning News. As you may have heard, Starbucks is now concerned about the noise level in its stores and is going to take measures to make the stores quieter. And to discuss this issue, we have an all-star panel composed of, first of all, somebody who's an expert in talking, that being G. Scott, who will be on the air at 9 o'clock, and someone who served, how long was your sentence as a Starbucks barista?
It ended up being about 5 years.
Wow. 5 years.
Yeah, some breaks here and there.
David Burbank. So, first of all, G., are you a Starbucks person?
Absolutely.
All right. So do you find it difficult to carry on a conversation because the stores are too noisy?
Yeah. Well, so here's where my expertise comes in. Yeah, I do a lot of talking, but Starbucks used to be, you know what I'm saying, the date spot, right? Oh. That's where folks that are broke, that's on a budget.
Really? I feel like Starbucks is so expensive.
Compared to, like, going out to dinner?
Sure, sure,
you know what I mean?
Okay, I get what you're saying.
So your boy used to just show up there at the Starbucks, and so it used to be a place that was quiet. Then I figured out there were certain Starbucks that you would go to, right, to know, oh, I know a quiet one. And then, you know, the busier ones are the ones that are usually closer to the mall or closest to a working area where people are coming in nonstop. And so I've learned this about myself. So the first time years ago, when I first moved here to Seattle area in 99, my father came to visit. I told him I was going to take him to this amazing restaurant that I had gone to called Buco de Beppo's, right? Yeah. And so I'm like, yes, I can't wait to take you there. The food's so good. So I take him there. We're there. And before the food comes, he's like, it's too loud in here for me. I can't take this. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's not loud. Here we are years later. I do not like being in loud establishments. Like, it bothers me. Yeah. So Starbucks, I'm for it on the quiet side. Now, that's from the customer side of things. According to what they're saying that it's hard for the baristas to be able to hear maybe from the outside, like, you know, people come to the drive-thru, or customers being able to shout their orders. You guys got to ask David about that, because your boy ain't never been a barista.
Well, I know about the noise, because I once took my order from the Starbucks and was halfway through it before I realized it wasn't mine.
Oh,
I
just,
I thought it was, you know, I thought I heard my name, but I hadn't. So, David, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it's this obviously varies widely between who are the managers and sort of shift leads, we would call them, at different stores. I've worked at 5 different Starbucks stores, and it varies. I've worked usually in the early hours of the morning, and some managers and some sort of opening shift managers really don't want loud music when they start. You know, they're also tired. They want to start the day off a little calmer, but some of them are very energetic. They want to get the music going, get the dance music going, get the energy up, because it feels like that, you know, then your baristas are more awake, they're more energetic. For me, I want a little bit of that happy medium. And especially when a lot of these stores are in-store and drive-through. When you're doing the drive-through, when you're the drive-through operator, it is impossible to hear people anyways, let alone when there's super loud music going on and people are shouting in the cafe, you know, being very, very loud. And so I think it's a really good idea to, in the cafe area, make it quieter, because not only is that going to help the baristas in the cafe, that's going to help the baristas in the drive-thru. You're not going to have that thing where you you give out a coffee that is not the correct coffee.
Well, why is the espresso machine so loud? It's like a subway train arriving.
Yeah. When they steam the milk.
Yeah. It's that pressurized water and hot air that does it.
So you're saying it's more of like a management sets the tone.
That's what I've done.
They build them to look so industrial and kind of empty with the open ceilings, and that just allows all the acoustics to bounce off the walls. So it makes sense that they would want to put in those dampening baffles or those foams, because they built these places to be loud. It's disturbing. I don't like it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, again, I just know the different Starbucks to go to. Like Mercer. Yeah. Hey, real quick. Mercer Island? Quiet.
Yes.
Quiet as a church mouse. You feel me? Yeah. Sammamish? Quiet, right? The one in Factoria, right there in Renton, loud. You know, like, what I tell y'all, see, again, thank you for your expertise, David, but I have my expertise, right? I've never worked in it, but I have been a patron. I've visited a lot of these places. I'm telling y'all now, for all the people that do these dates and stuff like that, Starbucks is the place to go. So you got to know the different Starbucks to go to. Now, I don't know about the managers or anything. I think it really comes down to the – Davis says the manager set the tone. I think the customers set the tone. You know what I mean? I think it's the customers that just kind of come in. And like I say, you go to Mercer Island, it's hello, David. Do you want it whipped, David? You want it stirred?
What's your order at Starbucks?
Yeah, what is your order?
It's typically sometimes I'm into the matcha tea. Wow. Other times I'm into the decaf caramel macchiato.
Ooh,
that's fancier than I would have expected.
Dave, you like to say that word, don't you, caramel macchiato?
Yeah, I do, and I sip it all day. I take it home with me, and I work on it.
This is a leftover from Friday, but gee, are you off the couch?
Oh, yes! I got a good night's sleep.
Good.
Thanks for asking, Colleen.
He was on the couch for a night. I'm worried about
it. I can't wait to hear about this.
David, have you ever slept on the couch before?
Only because we had guests. Not because I was sent there.
You've never slept? Oh, my gosh. You know what, Sully?
Anyway.
I'm so imperfect to be on this show. You guys still want me here?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Even though I don't go to Starbucks. Haven't been to one in like 15 years.
Coming in about 10 minutes on Car News Radio. Thank you, G.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.